Alan Kohler here, and this week's fund manager is Monique Kotecha, who is the Chief Investment Officer of InSync Funds Management. They've got two funds. They invest in megatrends and disruption. And Monique, always interesting on those subjects. So here he is, Monique Kotecha, the Chief Investment Officer of InSync Funds Management. Well, Monique, you've got a couple of funds, the Capital Aware Fund that uses put options or options to limit the downside, plus another fund that's just a straight long portfolio. But what strikes me is that over the past 12 months, the Capital Aware Fund has outperformed the other fund. They both handsomely outperformed the MSCI Accumulation Index. But how come the Capital Aware Fund outperformed the other one, since it probably pays for the options and it's got a higher fee, 1.3% versus 0.98? What's going on?
Yes, Alan. So, as you quite rightly said, both funds have done really well over the past 12 months. And in fact, it's been consistently been doing well over the last sort of 3 to 5 years. And the Capital Aware, as you quite rightly said, has an added feature. Both funds are identically managed. You know, they have 31 stocks across 16 global megatrends, same amount of cash, which is very little in both funds. But the Capital Aware has the put option feature. That typically costs about 2% over the cycle. And you really see, I think this year really shows the benefits of having that for those investors who are perhaps, want less volatility, may need that access to capital and don't want that downside volatility. You can see how that's come through very, very strongly. You know, if you looked at in the month of March, which is obviously right at in the eye of the storm, you know, when the markets were collapsing, the MSCI was down, I think, about 8.6%, and the Capital Aware was only down 4%. So, you know, we really protected the downside,
that accounts for the difference in performance between the two funds.
Absolutely. So that's all the difference between the two funds. That's exactly right, Alan.
Yeah, right. So, but apart from that, they're identical. They own the same stocks.
Absolutely, yeah. So the idea there is to offer investors a choice. You know, if you just want the long only and participate on those long-term sustainable trends, and you've got a long-term horizon, you don't mind the volatility, or you know, you already got an asset allocation strategy where the defensive part of your portfolio is already well structured, and you're saying, look, I want equities for the upside. Then you've got the long only, and if you're a client or investor saying, well, look, you know, I need that downside protection because, you know, I don't know, you've got things you need to spend on the next couple of years, might be your children or, you know, I don't know, upgrading your house or whatever it is, but I need the growth, then that's the added feature, Alan.
What's your minimum investment?
$10,000 into both funds.
Right. You're saying that you've got not much cash at the moment. Now, you're a growth investor. You're investing in megatrends, which we'll get onto in a moment. I take it if you haven't got much cash that you're pretty comfortable with the pricing levels in the market at the moment. You don't think that growth is overpriced?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is yes, we're still finding satisfactory, great opportunities, actually very good opportunities still at reasonable prices today. And look, our overall view on cash is that you should have minimal cash because if you look at various studies that have been done, Alan, whether you do it over 10, 20 years or 70 years, you know, if you miss the best 10 or 20 days in the market, your returns actually come down significantly. So market timing is it's near side impossible. I've been doing this for 30 years and you just can't consistently market time. But if you buy the right types of companies, what they do is they do inherently provide some downside protection. You know, if they've got very strong balance sheets, very high levels of profitability, you know, high level of, recurring earnings and a long runway of growth ahead of them, they actually provide downside protection. So, for us, the important thing is, you know, over time, the markets have gone up. And if you miss those market returns when they're going up, you actually reduce your returns significantly. So from our perspective, it's really important that we stay fully invested and really become much more focused on really finding the best ideas and spend our combined experience and all the time we've been learning about the industry over the last 90 years between the three major sort of fund managers on the portfolio to really pick the best ideas. We think we're much better suited to doing that.
So is there a price at which you wouldn't invest in an idea?
Absolutely.
How do you determine that?
That, again, very good. So we don't use PEs because PEs don't tell you anything about the quality of the business. They don't tell you about the long-term sustainable growth in the business. So we use the old, good old-fashioned discounted cash flow analysis, you know, something that Warren Buffett has extensively spoken about is really the true way of valuing a business. And every stock that we own has to trade at a discount to our assessed valuation, right? So we are valuation driven. So there are some stocks out there that we wouldn't own that might have a higher short-term PE, but there are other stocks that may have slightly higher elevated PE but still look very attractively priced on our long-term valuation models because, as I said, PEs only pick up the next 12 or 24 months of earnings. They do not pick up the sustainable growth over the next 5 or 10 years. And so...
What discount rate do you use?
So we tend to use a discount rate of typically around 9 to 10%, and we've been fairly consistent in that. So we don't, you know, just because interest rates have gone down, we don't reduce our discount rates accordingly. You know, we just increase the risk premium. So I think there's a generous discount rate that we use. You know, you could argue we should bring it down because if interest rates are very low, then investors should be expecting a slightly lower return out of all asset classes, but we've maintained a high discount rate.
Well, you can in fact make an argument that if the 10-year bond rate is under 1%, which it is, then the 9 or 10% discount rate is ridiculous, but it is, as you say, very conservative.
It is because, you know what, the beauty in the businesses that we own is they have extremely durable and very long-term growth rates ahead of them. You know, we're looking at least 10 years plus of very high levels of growth rate. So we don't need to have a low discount rate to try and bump up the valuation. You know, it's the sustainable growth, and it's not just the growth in revenues, Alan, it's about the profitability. What is the incremental dollar return you are getting for reinvesting those dollars into the runway of growth? It's like how any business owner would look at it, Alan. If you went out there and I said to you, you've got two opportunities here, you can invest in an opportunity, you know, where you can invest $100,000 every year into a new project and it'll give you a 40 or 50% return, which is the average return across our portfolio. Or I'm going to give you one which is going to give you a 10% return. Which is the better business out of the two that's going to generate much more superior earnings growth? It's clearly the one that's got the higher return on incremental capital, and that's what we focus on.
So you mentioned that you're investing in megatrends. What are the megatrends that you identify and focus on?
So we have 16 global megatrends. We have 31 stocks across 16 global megatrends, and that's very important because when you quite often hear about investors looking at trends, you normally think about technology, and certainly technology is an important component of our portfolio. But a large part of our portfolio are in non-tech mega trends. And what that does is it creates diversity across the portfolio and means that if one trend isn't working, Alan, the other 15 are working. So there's a nice diversity of mega trends. And just to give you some examples, you know, we're involved in healthcare. So, you know, immuno-oncology drugs to robotic-assisted surgery are two big mega trends in the healthcare space we're involved in. Another one is, the drive for value for money, you know, towards value for money shopping. You know, that's a major secular mega trend. There's been very little.
Do you mean online shopping by that?
No. Actually, I'm talking actually about discount stores. Okay, so if you look at let's just look at what happened pre-COVID. The 11 years to 2020, unemployment rates in Europe only returned to pre-crisis level 11 years after the GFC, and there was no wages growth, right? If you looked at the US, and this was some research done by Pew, despite a really healthy environment before COVID, where unemployment rates, as you know, were coming down towards the 3% mark in the US, adjusted for inflation, there was hardly any wage growth in terms of purchasing power over a 40-year period, okay? So there's been very little income growth coming through. So consumers, you know, consumers had to be very frugal in the way they've been shopping. Now, obviously, COVID has created an unemployment disaster out there, as we all know, right? And so what's happened is that it's driving a secular shift towards value for base money consumption. And the beneficiaries of that are discount stores, okay? So we've identified a company in the US, a discount dollar store, you know, generates very high returns on invested capital, intensely profitable company.
What's it called?
Dollar store.
Oh, dollar store, right, okay.
Dollar store, right, okay. And if you looked at the period in the, you know, post-COVID, if you looked at discount stores, it was the only part of retail that was growing at high single digits. So, you know, dollar store, for example, in April and May was growing at mid-teens in terms of sales growth. And in fact, it crossed 20% growth in June. So this is a bricks and mortar retailer, right? So think about bricks and mortar and think about the apocalypse that's occurred across that space. Here's a company that's grown at 20% in the middle of COVID, highly profitable, very strong balance sheet, and they can increase the number of stores they have by double over the next 5 to 7 years. So they've got a huge runway of growth to keep reinvesting into. So
it's interesting because you know, most people, when you talk about megatrends and disruptive investing and so on, think about technology, but actually that's a very non-technology company.
Exactly right. And I think that's very important because you know, if you're not careful, you can actually end up with a high degree of concentration in your portfolio. And that's something that we really focus on, because when you're building a portfolio, Alan, and you're constructing your portfolio, and I teach my children this, to be honest with you, you can get really excited by one area. But what you want to make sure is that you get diversity across your holdings. So you know, so they don't all go up for the same reason, because they will also all go down for the same reason, right? So you need to have diversity across your portfolio. And the way you measure that is through your what's called correlation. So I don't want to get too technical, but what correlation measures is basically when one goes up, how does the other stock go up in comparison to that? Does it go up one for one, or does it go up in a different way? And if you can find 20 or 30 stocks that sort of behave differently over a cycle, but they're all going to do very, very well, then that means you don't have high levels of concentration risk.
One of your mega trends is increasing travel, and that seems to be buggered now. Have you been caught with travel stock?
No. So we did a little bit into COVID, you know, and then again, when you've got 16 mega trends and one's not working, as you can see from our performance numbers, it didn't really hurt us too badly, you know.
No, it didn't. That's right.
But we sold one of our stocks. So we had two stocks in the portfolio, Alan. We had Amadeus. You'd be familiar with Amadeus. They do all the, you know, when you book a flight and you're booking your seat and, you know, through a travel agent or airline, they normally use the Amadeus booking system. So, you know, travel pre-COVID was growing at pretty close to two times GDP, okay? And Amadeus was an insanely profitable company generating very high returns on capital. And all they were doing was earning a clip of the ticket. Now, clearly, you know, airline travel is going to take a long time to come back. Still a very strong company. And so what we did is, within a short period of recognizing the travel, as you quite rightly said, was going to have a tough time, we sold out of it. But we held on to the other stock that we own, which is Booking. And you'll be familiar with the Booking app. Now, you know, Booking Holdings, which is the stock we still own in the portfolio, it was the only company in their space that had to raise no capital, had enough balance sheet capacity and liquidity to ride out COVID, okay? So they raised no capital during the downturn. A lot of travel-oriented companies, as you know, in Australia, you saw that with Webjet and Flight Centre, you know, had to rapidly go out there and raise a lot of capital. Well, Booking Holdings didn't need to raise any capital at all. Now, if you're a Hilton chain, for example, or if you're an Intercontinental Accor, okay, you know, your occupancies has been smashed, okay? Very low occupancy levels. And if you're looking to rebuild your occupancy now, as we're going to slowly start getting some sort of recovery in travel over time, which is the company you're going to go to? to try and rebuild your occupancy. It's going to be the strongest company out there, which is Booking. Okay. So interestingly, from a share price performance perspective, Booking Holdings has almost fully recovered the losses it made during COVID. So we're almost back to where we were. In fact, we're ahead of where we were when we actually first purchased the shares.
One of the themes that you focus on is demographics and population. I mean, which has a number of elements to it, such as the population growth rising and then perhaps falling. The growth in the power and sort of significance of women. Replacement rates and so on. Talk to us about how you invest. So how you think demographics affects your investment thinking, and then how you invest for it.
That's a you know, a really good question. And I think, you know, I think when people think about demographics, they always think about the aging population, and the aging population is a mega trend. There's no doubt about that. You know, the number of people over is set to more than double over the next 20, 30 years. So certainly one area that we do
have. I think you call that the silver economy, don't you?
Absolutely, the silver economy. So, you know, we've invested in two areas there. One is in robotic-assisted surgery. So we own a company called Stryker. And you know, as we get older, look, everyone starts suffering, you know, aches and pains, and then, you know, your hips start going, your knees start going, you know, you start getting a little bit wobbly. You can't do it. It's just a function of age. And what Stryker did was very early on, they identified the opportunities by using robots to assist in the surgery. So you still need the surgeon, but what the robot does is it generates much stronger outcomes for the patient. So they invested very, very early, and that's something we look for. You know, we look for management teams that are looking ahead, okay? They're investing. They're also looking at the next set of trends coming through, and they're investing ahead of the trend. And that's what Stryker did. So that's one way we got exposure. The other way we got exposure is you know, if you look at COVID-19, one of the clear things that's come out of that has been obviously, the importance of the healthcare system, right? You know, and I think there's now a refocus across various governments around the world. Some of them have been underinvesting and recognizing that they need to start spending a lot more money on healthcare. So if you looked at 2019, there were 48 new drug approvals in the US, which is the highest level in the last decade, okay? And many of these were first-in-class drugs. With a really strong potential to drastically improve people's life. Okay, a lot of them were actually focused on addressing chronic diseases, and that's obviously the big killer as we get older. So, one of the parts that we're exposed to, which we're very excited about, is the development of the immuno-oncology drugs. Okay, so if you look at in the US, for example, the estimated number of invasive cancer cases in the US alone in 2020 was around 1.8 million people, which is 4,700 victims per day. Okay, so that's a very large addressable market. You know, that market's going to grow from around 30 billion today to over 85 billion in the next 6 to 7 years. And there's only one or two companies within that space who have the R&D, the know-how, and the expertise to take advantage of that. So as we're getting older...
So what space are you talking about? This is immunosuppressant drugs?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
What companies are they?
So that would be a company like Bristol Myers Squibb, for example. Would be very strongly exposed to that, you know. Now that's an interesting example because we talked about valuations a bit earlier. Okay, so we've got stocks on PEs of 40 times in our portfolio, Alan, and Bristol Myers Squibb trades on a PE of 10 times. Okay, now we don't use PE ratios. Both of them have got very strong growth markets ahead of them. And our valuation methodology, which is this DCF-based methodology, tells us both stocks are cheap. So I just thought I'd just add that point, which is, you know, why we think PEs are irrelevant, because you're not really valuing the long-term growth. And yet here we've got one stock that's trading on 10 times earnings. So, you know, we're, you know, very excited by it.
This is Bristol Myers Squibb, right?
Correct.
That's probably, they're probably seen as a bit of a boring old pharma company, aren't they?
Absolutely. And yet if you look under the hood, you know, they've got some, you know, they've got over 10 drugs in late stage, you know, phase three trials at the moment. And you only need one or two of them to really be very successful to make a big difference to their growth profile going forward. So that's exactly right.
Tell us some of your other more important mega trends. Probably shouldn't run through the whole 16, but maybe some of the ones that are more important, you think?
Yeah, but look,
I guess China is one, is it? China is one.
I mean, you know, the mega trends we have are exposed, you know, they typically have a global footprint. So, you know, we don't have a stock that's just China-centric per se. I mean, the one that stands out within that space is Estée Lauder in beauty and skincare. And, you know, if you look at, the fact that we're all, you know, well, until recently, you know, there were more women entering the workforce, and I think that trend will reassert itself. The fact that we're spending more time on social media, and also the fact that as we're getting older, we tend to use maybe not so much beauty products, but certainly skincare products. If you look at the growth in prestige beauty, which is where we're really focused, because that's where the highest margins are, Alan, and that's where you get the biggest bang for the buck in terms of investment. So the return on capital are really, really high. Then, you know, that part of the market has been growing at double GDP pre-COVID, and because a lot of those companies have migrated onto online very, very quickly, and that's very important. These aren't just bricks and mortar companies, you know, who are traditionally used department stores to sell their products, but they've all now really pivoted into the online world, and that's where a lot of the sales comes through from. You know, that's an area where that's an area where we do have some exposure to the emerging markets, because in places like South Korea, for example, they spend much more time putting putting makeup on, and they spend much more on products. You know, they typically have 6 or 7 or 8 beauty products sitting in the bathroom. So that's
an exposure. you've invested in Estée Lauder, haven't you?
Correct. That's exactly right. So there's an example there. Another important trend for us, and again, you know, COVID has just highlighted the critical importance of health, right? I mean, if you looked at what's the biggest of mortality rates as a result of COVID, it's been poor health. So there's this big drive now towards health and wellness, and you know, that's already an industry that's it's enormous in size. If you look at the total health and wellness industry, it's, you know, the market size is $4 trillion. It's absolutely enormous. And what COVID has done is accelerated the trend towards athleisure. So this is athletic and leisure. So you're seeing a lot more people walking around, a lot more people now buying athletic wear that they use not only to go to the gym, but they use that just to spend time at home. Some of them actually wear that into the office. You know, they're looking at their shoes and they're looking at the technical capability of their shoes. So there's a lot more, you know, if you look at the amount of spend that's gone into athletics wear, it's actually increased post-COVID, okay? And that's a trend that we think is going to keep on growing well ahead of GDP for decades to come. So a stock that we've invested in that trend is Adidas, you know, and, you know, if you look at Adidas, Nike, Puma, you know, all of those companies are doing very, very well. They were doing well pre-COVID, but what COVID has done is accelerated the trend towards athleisure. So there's another example of a non-tech company where we just see very strong growth ahead and where we can find highly profitable companies to benefit from that trend. So there's some examples of non-tech trends within the Insing portfolio, Alan.
What do you think is going to happen to interest rates, and for how long will it happen, and how does that affect your thinking about investing?
Look, we've been in a sustained period of low inflation, low growth, and as a result, low interest rates now for an extended period of time. And as you know, both the RBA which appears to have guided interest rates a little bit lower. You know, you wouldn't have thought it would got any lower. And in the US, they're talking about keeping rates lower for longer because they're just not seeing any signs of inflation. So, you know, I think going forward, regardless of whoever comes in, I mean, there is some talk that if Biden comes in and if the Democrats get a clean sweep, there's going to be massive fiscal stimulus. And that's going to lead to an increase in inflation and ultimately an increase in interest rates. And I think the market may start to factor, it's already factored a little bit of that in today, and may start to more aggressively factor that in the short term. But if you look under the hood and if you look at the sustainable trends, you think about the demographics, you know, when people get older, they tend to spend less. You think about the debt load, you know, when you have tremendous amount of debt, you know, that impacts your growth rate, your capacity to spend going forward. And you think about the impact of technology on labor. You know, one of the reasons why wage costs have been particularly low and have continued to trend lower is because of the impact that technology is having on the labor market, right? There's a lot of automation and displacement of labor that's actually occurring. So our strong view at the end of the day is that we're going to continue this for this period of low interest rates and low inflation for an extended period of time. So you really want to focus on, that's why we're focused on the mega trends. You want to be focused on sustainable, so sustainable is a really important word, sustainable growth companies that have high levels of profitability, because when you do that, you're buying businesses that have very little sensitivity to the GDP, right? And that's what came through in our numbers, right? At the end of the day, we weren't concerned about the shape of the recovery. There's a lot of chitter-chatter about how's the recovery going to unfold and how should one position the portfolio. But if you take the structural view, which is the way we've done it, and then you buy businesses that have very little sensitivity to the GDP, so they just keep marching forward regardless of what the economic cycle is going to be doing, you know, you are going to be spending more online and an increasing amount regardless of what GDP does, right? You're going to get a little bit older. The aging population is going to keep on moving that direction regardless of what GDP does. If you can find stocks that are going to benefit from that in a profitable way, then I think you're going to do very, very well going forward. So that's our view. Lower interest rates for longer. Very difficult for companies to grow, which is why a lot of established businesses are struggling at the moment. And so that's really going to be supportive of secular growth businesses, particularly the ones that are generating very healthy margins and what we call returns on invested capital.
And have you developed a strong view about what the course of the virus is going to be? I mean, and how you think that's going to unfold?
Look, very, very.
Now?
I mean, yeah, look, it's obviously reasserted itself. But look, our view is that over time, the virus will disappear, testing will improve, we may well come with a vaccine. I mean, they're obviously working very hard at it. We know vaccines are incredibly difficult, to create. I mean, it's one of the most difficult ills, but you've got some of the sharpest minds who are, and drug companies around the world who are collectively working towards creating one. So, look, ultimately, this virus will disappear and economies will start to recover. And as it recovers, I think the markets will start doing very, very well, Alan.
Just finally, it's probably a fairly big question, but one of the things I'm finding at the moment is, as I talk to people like you and fund managers in general, the sense is that, well, there's a sense that those who invest in sort of growth companies, technology companies at high PEs are essentially speculators, that there's a sort of a momentum trade going on, that there's a lot of retail investors coming into this space via Robinhood and so on, and that it's kind of tends to be dominated by speculators. However, listening to you and to other people who are, you know, investing in the mega trends and disruptive themes, you're actually a long-term investor. You're not a speculator. In some ways, growth investors are the kind of the longer-term investors than value investors in a way. I mean, how do you reconcile that in your mind and think about that, the sort of the long-term versus the prices you're paying? Is it entirely just covered by using DCF, discounted cash flow as your valuation tool?
Yeah, look, it is a big question. You're absolutely right. And I'll do my best to answer it because I do have a strong view. So look, post-COVID, there's no doubt that a lot of there is an element of speculation that's entered the market in our view. Now, some of these companies, what the market's done is, you know, particularly the less profitable, the unprofitable companies, they're the ones that we wouldn't invest in. You know, the growth is great, but you need to be very profitable. And that's what we focus on. We think there is a segment of market out there that is showing exuberance within the growth space. But what COVID has done is it's accelerated the trend towards a lot of these areas, right? So the payment space would be one, for example, where we've seen significant acceleration. But there's a lot of companies out there, that are just not generating the profit. So I think there is an element of speculation out there. You know, I wouldn't blame it all on the retail investors. I mean, if you looked at a lot of the institutional data, Alan, it actually showed that most professional managers were still very conservative and negative. Okay, so a lot of them have actually missed out, I think, on the recovery that's actually taken place. So that's the way they're positioned. In terms of valuations, you know, the difference between now and 2000 is, yes, there is an element of froth there. You certainly want to stay away from the froth. But if you look at the leading, let's call it the tech companies, and as I said, that's only a part of our portfolio. We try and diversify. I made that point a bit earlier. But we do have some tech companies there. And if you look at those technology companies, you know, unlike 2000, they are some of the most profitable businesses on earth, okay? And what's happened is that, you know, there's a term in our industry called mean reversion. And what mean reversion is basically, if you're generating very high profits, automatically competition will come in and your profits will come down. And what's happened with a certain group of companies is the opposite has happened. Their positioning has actually become stronger and stronger, and COVID has accelerated their competitive positioning. They've actually, you know, so they've benefited from growth and their competitive position has become stronger. So they're, unlike 2000, a lot of these companies are intensely profitable, and the multiples you're paying for it, even on a short-term basis like PE, is less than what it was during the tech bubble. Right. And you can justify part of that because rates are low. Okay. When interest rates are lower, you can pay more for a business. Okay. That's the simple maths at the end of the day. And so if you think rates are going to stay lower for longer, these businesses, particularly if they continue to grow profitably, are highly valuable businesses in a low growth environment. Okay. They're actually scarce. You know, growth is a scarce commodity at the end of the day. So yes, DCFs do go some way towards justifying some of the valuations, and we spend a lot of time ensuring that the assumptions we're using are reasonable when we're measuring the growth. You know, I mean, if you tell me, Monik, you know, because some people are skeptical of DCFs, you know, they sit there and they go, well, that depends on your growth assumptions, but we can measure what the growth in the industry is. Okay, we can see the growth in the company. We know how big that industry is going to become over time. So how wrong am I going to be in my Microsoft valuation over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years? I don't think I'm going to be that wrong, okay? Because you know, it's already a very strong company. We know how much they're reinvesting, and we know what the incremental return they're getting on every dollar they're reinvesting. And we know, we can see that the growth, the size of the growth ahead of them. If you ask me what CBA's earnings are going to be like in 5 years, I have absolutely no idea. Bank earnings, okay? Tell me what Rio's earnings are going to be in 5 years. I don't know, okay? It's very hard.
Have you invested in buy now, pay later? And if not, why not?
Well, we haven't because look, it's a relatively new area of growth, a lot of revenue growth. Not a lot of profitability yet. And what happens with a lot of new emerging industries is people get very excited about the revenue growth, right? And it is growing very quickly, okay? There's no doubt about it. But because there's a lot of competition, the companies that are benefiting from that growth in revenues aren't actually getting the margin, the cash flow, and the profitability coming through. So it's very hard to determine who the winners are going to be. And quite often what happens is that when you get growth, like in the buy now, pay later space, you sometimes find that the established players in the payment space are watching, they're monitoring it. And then when they realize that there's a real trend there, they step onto that trend and they've got the balance sheet and they've got the customers and their network to really take advantage of that trend. So if you look at that space now, PayPal, right, which is the largest, you know, it's got the largest number of merchants globally that use their, you know, their payment process, have now gone into that space. Okay, so what does that mean for the existing younger players who are participating in that? So the answer is, we haven't directly invested in that, but through our investment in PayPal, which is benefiting from this move towards cashless, the move towards contactless payments, and now they're going to benefit from their move into the buy now, pay later space as well. So that's the way we've invested.
We'll have to leave it there, Monique. So it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan. An absolute pleasure.
That was Monique Kotecha, the Chief Investment Officer of InSync Funds Management.